Please call the case.
Good morning, counsel. Good morning, Mr. Kane. Counsel, are you all ready to proceed this morning? Mr. Kane? Okay, and Ms. Bronster, I understand you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll have the yellow light come on warning you when you are reaching that point in your argument, and then Mr. Kang will give you a warning with 10 minutes to go. Very well. Please proceed.
First, let me thank you for having the opportunity to appear this morning before you justices. I appear on behalf of Wavecom Solutions, formerly known as PLNI, and because all of the Record on Appeal and the ICA referred to PLNI, Pacific LightNet, I will use that terminology this morning. Your Honors, neither the filed rate doctrine nor the primary jurisdiction doctrine justify vacating the jury's verdict in favor of PLNI or the dismissal of PLNI's claims. PLNI seeks only to enforce the tariff that was approved by the PUC and obtain credits under the tariff for two specific circumstances. These issues were tried to a jury in 2007 and should be reinstated. The first claim is a claim for a refund that was owed to GST, PLNI's predecessor. It is a simple collection issue. GST claimed the refund, and Time Warner agreed not only to the existence of the refund and that it was owed, but also to the precise amount that was owed, $327,000. It was a credit that was owed to GST and transferred to PLNI, and that is not disputed. However, it was not paid. That too is not disputed. That issue was admitted by Time Warner not only on the trial on the merits, but also in the very motion to dismiss. PLNI stated that it did not object to the fact that the credit was owed. Time Warner wrote, Time Warner denies the allegations about the payment because it has already resolved the billing issue for claims prior to 2002. And when the evidence showed that the claim that had been resolved was not paid, the jury rightfully decided that it should be paid to PLNI.
What was their defense at trial regarding that amount then?
Your Honor, I don't believe they had one. They argued a lot of things, but with respect to the amount owed, they did not argue that it was improper. In fact,
would the tariff's requirement that there be 120 days or that the claim be submitted 120 days after, the incident, otherwise that would be waived, would that provision of the tariff apply to the $327,000 claim?
Your Honor, there was no suggestion that that was not timely made. By the time we were in trial in 2007, the matter had already been resolved. Time Warner had not claimed that that was not timely. In fact, the $327,000 evidence was in D-22, and in D-22, Time Warner wrote the issue was determined, they walk through the history of it, and they say the issue was determined closed because of a credit issued on June 15th, 2002 invoice in which the $327,714.03 was credited to the Honolulu portion of the bill.
So isn't their argument that it was already paid?
As it turned out, while they thought it had already been paid, the evidence at trial showed that it was not.
Right. So how does that require any technical expertise to figure out whether something's been paid or not paid?
We believe that that's precisely the issue that the court and the ICA got wrong. There is nothing technical and nothing required by the PUC to show an admitted amount due had not been paid.
Excuse me, and maybe I misheard you, but you said that that's something that the circuit court got wrong?
Well, this,
because I don't see that the circuit court gave any reasons.
We're assuming, I suppose.
Okay.
And I think that the circuit court did not address the issue. In fact, when the circuit court granted the motion to dismiss for primary jurisdiction, what the circuit court said was, I want all this to go up at once. And really, that was there was not a lot of discussion. When the ICA discussed it, there was a suggestion that it needed some special competence of the PUC, but we don't believe that that's the case.
Did anybody request findings? It just seems so unusual. I mean, jury trial is completed, and then there's a motion, and the judge rules and doesn't give any reasons, and then there's just an order with no findings.
It was pretty surprising, Your Honor.
Ms. Braunstein, considering the application of primary jurisdiction, what standard of review should we use, and whether the court erred?
Your Honor, we believe that it should be de novo.
It's not abuse of discretion?
No, it's not. It is a question of jurisdiction, and we believe that the court should review it de novo.
What about factual issues related to the highly technical or the potentially technical application of the PUC's rules and regulations? In other words, wouldn't it seem that the trial court is in the best position to weigh these arguments? And on your side, it's very simple, straightforward. On Time Warner's side, it's extremely complicated. There's a lot of very sophisticated analysis that has to take place. Wouldn't the trial court be in the best position to analyze those factual issues, and shouldn't we give some deference to their judgment?
Your Honor, first, I don't believe that you should give deference, particularly since the circuit court did not make any such findings. There were no findings made, and if you look at the record, there is nowhere in the record where it says anywhere that there was any question, any complication whatsoever with respect to the $327,000.
I'm talking in general.
In general. I think in general, Your Honor.
And things get a lot more complicated when we get to the other issues, so I guess I'm jumping ahead. But
no, and I think that's right. But I think that the guidance is that what you have to do is look at it on a case-by-case basis. Even the U.S. Supreme Court case that served as the basis for the long line of Hawaii cases, the U.S. versus Pacific Western Railroad case, said in language that is not often quoted in Hawaii, but it went on after talking about primary jurisdiction to say no fixed formula exists for applying the doctrine of primary jurisdiction. In every case, the question is whether the reasons for the existence of the doctrine are present and whether the purposes it serves will be aided by its application in the particular litigation. There can be no purpose served here where the issue was admitted by Time Warner Telecom to send this to the PUC when it is particularly within the ken of the court to decide whether or not a credit has been repaid. And I think, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Would the 120-day provision in the tariff apply to the second claim, that is the, canceling of overcharges? And I guess the jury decided the cancellation should be $118,000?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you had asked for $139,000,
right? Yes, Your Honor. I think that the ICA sort of missed that point. The ICA simply assumed that the jury did not apply the 120 days. But we believe that the record shows that, in fact, they were instructed with respect to the 120-day issue. It was in the jury instructions, and we believe that they applied it, which is why we believe that they reduced the amount from the original amount requested to the $118,000 credit. And again, this is precisely the type of collection matter that Brown and the other federal cases would say are perfectly within the ability of the court.
Is it easy to discern how the jury arrived at the difference between 139 and 118?
Your Honor, yes, I think if you take a look at the record, and let me take a moment and talk about what the second issue was. The second issue related to whether or not PLNI actually received the services that it was billed for. And it was not a highly technical matter. What the issue was PLNI, the bills showed calls originating from the mainland. Not technical. Whether or not the area code was a non-808 area code. That is certainly within the ability of the court and the jury to look at. What PLNI argued was that bills originating from the mainland were not properly billed to PLNI because Pacific Lightnet had no mainland customers, period. A very simple matter.
Now, not all the phone calls were from the mainland, all right?
Okay, there are two types of phone calls in the second issue. One was, if it was from the mainland, it was not chargeable to PLNI. And so PLNI asked the jury to zero those out, which they did. There were also claims going to the mainland. So from an 808 PLNI customer to a mainland phone. Again, a very simple issue. And the claims going to the mainland could not have been properly charged by Time Warner to PLNI because PLNI used Sprint to route its claims, its calls to the mainland. There were no calls terminated by Time Warner from PLNI. That was the sum and substance of the claim that PLNI made and the request for refund. So with respect to that.
So Time had charged you for those calls that indicated they didn't either originate in Hawaii or, I guess, replaced from Hawaii. I mean, originated in Hawaii or came from the mainland to Hawaii.
Correct. And the evidence also shows that the argument that you needed a lot more information to try and figure out how these billing errors showed up was really not relevant. First of all, Time Warner failed to provide that information to Pacific Lightnet, so there was no way for Pacific Lightnet to have it. So it's a little bit odd that Time Warner relied so heavily on that issue. But more importantly, the why the bills were wrong is irrelevant. It's just as if I pay my phone bill twice, and I say, I sent you two checks, you didn't give me the credit for the both checks, I want one of my checks back. Why they didn't give me credit for the second check really is not an issue. The fact of the matter is that I paid two checks, I'm entitled to a credit for one of them, and that is certainly within the ability of the courts to decide, particularly since the court did decide it when it had jurisdiction. We have to remember that the court and the PUC had concurrent jurisdiction. So when the jury issued its verdict, jurisdiction existed in the circuit court, and they properly exercised that jurisdiction. It wasn't until after the jury verdict that the court decided, no, primary jurisdiction exists in the PUC, and I will send it over there.
But how can we be confident that the jury did, in fact, apply the 120-day window? In other words, is there something about the verdict that, you know, it was argued in a certain way that makes it clear that the jury accepted an argument that it had to exclude the 120 days. Where does that, where does the 118,000 come from?
Okay. Well, the 118,000 comes from the jury's calculation. They did not ask a question about it, and they did not give us any indication on the verdict form. However,
that's why I'm asking the question. How do we know that? How can we be confident that this jury didn't violate the filed rate doctrine by recognizing claims outside the 120
days? I think when you look at the jury verdict, What you see is what they were instructed. They were instructed that the tariffs are the law. They were given copies of the tariffs. They were told on at least four or five occasions by Time Warner executives, and it was argued that anything beyond 120 days is time barred.
Now, the 120 days triggers from the date of the billing, right?
Yes.
Was the evidence clear by Time Warner when they actually did the billing?
No.
And that's what I think what the jury was called upon to make decisions upon.
Well, to the extent that there were, in the later years, it was clear when the billing was made and when the objection was made. And we believe that that's what adds up to the $118,000. There was a period of time where there was some uncertainty, where PLNI was asking for a lot of information, was not given that information, and those were the bills that were not accepted by the jury, which is what leads us to believe that the jury did, in fact, apply the 120 days. And we are not asking, and we did not believe that we thought that PLNI was exempt from any of the terms of the tariff, that the tariff should be discriminatorily enforced. All of those things, obviously, would be barred by the filed rate doctrine. But a pure collection issue as to whether or not PLNI was properly billed for something that it did not receive, we think is covered by some, for example, the Brown case, which is a Ninth Circuit case, which analyzed both the filed rate doctrine and the primary jurisdiction doctrine, and actually was cited by this court in the Balthazar case.
So you're saying the 120-day requirement did apply to the second issue?
Yes.
That is that where you were overbilled?
Yes, Your Honor.
That went from what dates? From, was it October 2001? After October 2001?
It was, I believe it started in 2004.
The court qualified the 120-day requirement by saying, telling the jury that it went only to delay, whereas the tariff says the 120-day waiver would, in effect, bar the claim. So was that a variation then from the tariff?
No, Your Honor. What happened was Time Warner Telecom failed to answer the complaint from 2003 when the complaint was first filed until two business days prior to the start of trial. So on August 30th, 2007, they filed an answer to the complaint adding some 20 or 30 affirmative defenses. There was a motion to strike those affirmative defenses as being untimely, and the court granted the motion to strike the affirmative defenses. However, although one of the affirmative defenses was the timeliness, when the case went forward, the court did issue the instruction saying that the tariffs constitute the law that the jury was supposed to apply.
But the court didn't specifically instruct the jury that they should exclude anything more than 120 days.
That's correct.
Are you conceding that even if your client did not receive any services that were billed, the 120-day waiver would apply under the filed rate doctrine?
Your Honor, we would like not to concede that. However, we believe that that's what the jury found, and we did not appeal that issue.
All right. So, but you do argue in your brief that, you know, as in Balthazar, as you say, the Brown case, the filed rate doctrine does not bar consideration of if plaintiffs pay the filed rate but arguably did not receive a benefit or service in exchange for the payment.
Yes, Your Honor, and we believe that that is simply an application of an enforcement of the tariffs. The tariff does not require a customer to pay for services it did not receive.
Right, so
as a matter of policy, does it make sense for, so in other words, if we say that everything is barred by 120 days as a matter of law, there's a waiver, it would encourage, what incentive would there be to make sure that your bills are correct, you're correctly billing your clients?
Well, unfortunately, the way the filed rate works,
if you can get by with it after 120 days,
and I think that that's really, I mean, as a policy matter, you don't want to encourage anyone who's a regulated industry to put things into the filed rates that are not going to be fair and not going to be able to give people a right to contest them. However, I think the filed rate doctrine is such that if it were clearly spelled out in the tariff that if you overpaid, you don't get it back, and that was approved, then that would be a problem with the filed rate. But we don't believe that that is the circumstance here.
Was the tariff itself submitted as evidence to the jury?
It was submitted as evidence, and it was provided as part of the jury instructions, yes.
And did the tariff have in it the 120-day limit?
Yes, it did, and it was repeatedly referred to by counsel and the witnesses for Time Warner Telecom. So although the court had originally indicated that she would not allow the filed rate doctrine, I'm sorry, the 120-day affirmative defense to be used, in fact, on many occasions it was.
Does it make sense to submit the law by way of exhibits? You have the court telling the jury that the tariff is the contract and is the law, but the tariffs themselves are not part of the instructions. I mean, I guess you can argue they're incorporated by reference, but the tariffs themselves are exhibits submitted, given to the jury, correct?
And the jury was clearly told to follow the tariffs as the law, that not only were the tariffs contracts, but they were the law of the case. And they were presented to the jury. So for those reasons, I think by getting into an issue of attempting to let each of these things go to the PUC, I think we are creating a situation where you are denying PLNI and others similarly situated from the ability to go to court for something that the court has done, can do, and should do, and particularly in a case like this where the jury had already ruled. I'd like to reserve additional time.
Thank you. Mr. Kang, your argument.
Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices, may it please the Court, Brian Kang, if you're in. Your Honor, I'd like to address Justice Acoba's last question to counsel first with respect to the jury instructions. I don't think that there's any doubt, obviously, that the jury received the tariffs as exhibits. But they weren't instructed specifically on the 120-day rule in the jury instructions. And it cannot be that by submitting exhibits to the jury, that that constitutes proper instructions to the jury.
Should the court have read the entire tariff as law?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe every single aspect of the tariff was relevant to this particular case, but there were a number of provisions in that tariff which were very relevant to the case, which we've cited in the briefs. And as the court is aware, the tariffs are not lay documents. They are very fairly complex documents with many, many provisions in them.
Why did you not file an answer until 2 days before the trial started?
Your Honor, we did not realize, frankly, the types of claims that would arise at trial until very shortly before the trial. And I do understand the answer was struck as belated, but there were a number of representations by Peel and I prior to that that there would be some continuing extensions of time to file the answer. And it was filed. There were a number of defenses in there, but that is the reason why it was filed later on and close to the proceedings.
And your motion, you simultaneously filed a motion to dismiss?
I believe, Your Honor, it was filed perhaps on the same day or the day after. As I recall, it was fairly close in time to the answer.
I think it was a little bit later, wasn't it? It seems to me you filed the motion to dismiss. Well, it looks like to me, actually, after your defenses got struck, you filed your answer on the August 30th. Then the following day, after you filed your answer, the court struck the affirmative defenses. And then you said, or you apparently determined, uh-oh, we better not be here. And then you filed a motion to dismiss, and it's filed the day the jury is being selected for trial?
That's correct, Your Honor. I believe, Justice Pollack, you're correct on the timing, because one of the defenses that the circuit court allowed and permitted Time Warner Telecom to proceed with was a jurisdictional defense, subject matter jurisdiction. So at that point, yes, Time Warner Telecom proceeded to file the motion to dismiss based on the primary jurisdiction doctrine, which in our view, Your Honor, under this court's holdings in Kona Old and its progeny, is not waivable and can be submitted and raised at any time.
So you could have asserted that on cert for the first time?
Your Honor, we believe we could have. We could have raised that argument and that position on cert or at any time during appeal as well. And so we, in fact...
Primary jurisdiction is concurrent jurisdiction, is it not?
It is, Your Honor, and that is one of the arguments that Peel and I raises, that because the circuit court has concurrent jurisdiction with the PUC, that somehow the primary jurisdiction doctrine shouldn't apply in this case, and that's just not correct. You know, under Kona Old, for example, it was clear that the Zoning Board of Appeals had jurisdiction, but it was also clear that the circuit court had jurisdiction because there was a specific statute that gave the circuit court jurisdiction. And in Kona Old, this court determined that even though the circuit court had concurrent jurisdiction, it was appropriate under the primary jurisdiction doctrine to refer the matter to the Zoning Board of Appeals.
When was the issue of primary jurisdiction raised procedurally in the Kona Old case?
I believe it was fairly early in the litigation, Your Honor. I believe it was fairly early. But the timing of the raising of the primary jurisdiction doctrine, respectfully, we don't believe... should be a dispositive factor. In the Chun case, with respect to the retirement benefit case, the issue of the primary jurisdiction doctrine was raised, and the matter was referred back to the administrative agency after motions for summary judgment had been heard. And again, in our view, the primary jurisdiction doctrine cannot be waived as a matter of subject matter jurisdiction.
So if you had prevailed, so if you had prevailed at trial, then what would probably have happened, of course, you would have withdrawn your motion.
I don't know, we could have. Your
That's
head,
right,
at that
you
point.
Could have.
I
don't ask this question lightly. It just seems to me that kind of timing allows kind of playing with the system.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the defense of subject matter jurisdiction was an appropriate defense to make.
This is primary jurisdiction.
That's correct, Your Honor. And again, subject matter jurisdiction, in our view, can be raised at any time. It is a defense that is not waivable. And in this particular instance, we had filed the motion, and we had requested that the motion be heard. And it was the circuit court's determination
Did you file a motion to continue trial?
We did not, Your Honor.
Did you come up here and ask for a petition of mandamus to stop the trial from going?
We did not, Your Honor.
So you allowed the trial to go. You filed it on the day of the jury trial starts. And then the document was like 150 pages altogether or something like that?
And again, Your Honor, we believe that it was not waivable. It was a defense that was available to Time Warner Telecom properly, and we had requested that it be heard, and it was the circuit court that made a determination that the trial should proceed.
Mr. Kang, do you have any authority other than you keep saying that subject matter jurisdiction can't be waived? This is clearly a question of primary jurisdiction. Do you have any authority for saying primary jurisdiction can't be waived?
I don't have specific authority, Your Honor. The only authority that I do have is the Kona Old case, which characterizes primary jurisdiction as an aspect of subject matter jurisdiction. And I believe that this court has viewed primary jurisdiction as an aspect of subject matter jurisdiction that should not be waivable.
Do you agree with Ms. Bronster that the standard of review is right wrong?
I do, Your Honor, in the sense that I think this court has determined that it is an aspect of subject matter jurisdiction, and subject matter jurisdiction is subject to the right-wrong standard. That being said, Your Honor, you know, we believe the circuit court obviously was in the best position to review the issues and the technical issues in this case and make a determination that there was a regulatory scheme in which these issues were properly referable to the Public Utilities Commission.
Has this court ruled in a number of cases in terms of when we have this court has applied primary jurisdiction that it's not necessary to dismiss the case, that it can be stayed,
that
remand? If this is a subject matter jurisdiction issue, how in the world could the court just stay the action? How can you argue that this is a subject matter jurisdiction issue?
Well, Your Honor, I'm faced with the fact that that is how the court has characterized primary jurisdiction. But under the primary jurisdiction doctrine, courts are allowed flexibility in terms of how to apply it once the court determines that the matter should be referred to the administrative agency.
So therefore, you concede that the courts are allowed flexibility as to how the court should deal with it.
That's correct,
Your Honor. So are you arguing that this is an abuse of discretion issue?
Well, Your Honor, if I had my druthers, yes. I would certainly argue that it is an abuse of discretion standard in the sense that the court must make a determination as to how to best proceed under the primary jurisdiction doctrine. I'm faced, obviously, with the authority of this court that says that primary jurisdiction is an aspect of subject matter jurisdiction. But certainly, you know, I think the reality is that the circuit court, and particularly in this case, and, you know, I guess there is argument by PLNI in terms of the timing of when the motion was particularly heard, but, you know, what resulted from that is that the circuit court clearly had a very comprehensive understanding of the factual issues in this case and the extensive testimony with respect to the technical issues in this case to make a determination on that record as to whether the case should be referred to the PUC under the primary jurisdiction doctrine.
But Mr. Kang, you never raised a question about the verdict being supported by substantial evidence.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So, as far as we have on the record, the verdict was supported by substantial evidence.
That is what you have on the record, Your Honor. That
okay.
being said,
and you never contested that.
We did not raise that issue. That's correct.
Let me ask you about the $375,000. Would the 120-day rule apply to the $375,000?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, our view is that the 120-day rule does, in fact, apply to the $327,000 claim. And the reason for that is the form disputing those charges was submitted by PLNI on September 18, 2001. And that form disputing the charges and claiming the credit extended for billings that occurred from May 2000 to September 2001. So on its face, Your Honor,
yeah.
We believe that it applies.
But did you ever raise that at trial?
Yes, we did, Your Honor.
Even though I assume the $375,000 was actually a figure time arrived at, right? Because PLNI was saying it was $220,000 or something to that effect.
I believe it is a figure.
Yeah, I think Time did an investigation
yes.
and then came up with, a higher number.
That's correct.
And
that's correct.
If these were late claims, would you credit GST with $375,000, as you said Time did?
I believe Time Warner Telecom's position at trial, Your Honor, is that we would not have credited the entire amount for that. But that being said,
the exhibit showed that you credited
right.
GST with $375,000.
Yes, that is
so,
correct, Your Honor.
So if those claims were late, they violated the tariff, would you have done that, or would Time have done that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, would Time Warner have,
sorry.
Have violated the...
Excuse me. So if some of those claims that made up the $375,000 were late and therefore in violation of the tariff, with time have credited GST with the $375,000?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I just don't recall the factual circumstance.
Let me ask you this then.
Yes.
In fact, did the exhibit show that time did credit GST with $375,000?
I believe it did, Your Honor. I believe it did. And, you know, if it was in violation of the tariff, you know, that was a violation of the tariff if it extended beyond 120 days.
So would it make any sense to refigure whether or not the 120-day rule would apply to 375 if time already claims, or their position is, they in effect credited after an investigation GST with that amount?
I think it does, Your Honor, because one of the issues at trial was who did Time Warner Telecom credit that amount to? And you know, Time Warner Telecom's position was that it had already credited the amount to GST.
That doesn't go to the amount, though, does it?
That is correct, Your Honor. But one of the positions of Time Warner Telecom, though, is that it did make the credit, and, you know, it cannot, under the tariffs, make another credit of a same or similar amount again, you know, to another entity.
What was the factual issue from Time Warner's side? I think that Ms. Bronster says, you know, really a very straightforward collections matter. So what about this particular aspect of the dispute require the special expertise of the PUC to resolve?
Well, Your Honor, the aspect of the dispute that required the PUC's expertise, in our view, was that on the credit issue, there was a fairly extensive amount of testimony on these what are known as CICs, carrier identification codes. And in PLNI's view, these are simply accounts. They're numbered accounts. In our view, it extends beyond just simply numbered accounts. These carrier identification codes specifically describe how these calls, where these calls are coming from, and you need this information in order to determine how these calls are being routed as well. And you need to delve into these carrier identification codes in order to make that determination.
This is on the $327,000 issue or the second issue?
That's the $327,000 issue, Your Honor. With respect to the other issue, which were the alleged ongoing.
Although that's technical, what is it about the PUC's expertise that requires that a PUC, you know, staff member, lawyer, accountant, those resources be dedicated to addressing that as opposed to having the parties present and analyze the issue and present it to the jury like any other complex issue? Juries consider very complex issues
right.
all the time.
And you're correct, Your Honor. Juries consider very complex issues. In this particular instance, you know, the PUC has the staff, it has the resources, it has the familiarity with the terminology, with the lingo, with the impact that these carrier identification codes would have with respect to trying to investigate this dispute. Which brings me to another point, Your Honor, in terms of the complexity of the matter. In our view, it is complex, you know, with respect to not only the credit, but also with respect to the ongoing billing disputes, in the sense that what was undisputed at trial is that in order to make a determination of whether the bills were properly charged, you needed these call detail records in order to figure that out.
Did you introduce any of those records, though?
We did not, Your Honor. We did not introduce those records. There was no request in discovery to produce those records, and you know those records were not available at trial.
Yeah, but if you're saying, I mean, they went forward showing a credit. If you're saying, look, you don't owe that amount, and you don't put in the records, and then you say this is too confusing for a jury, and you haven't given them the record, I guess I'm missing something.
Well, Your Honor, the call detail records were not available at trial, but. You know, in our view, PLNI could have asked for them in discovery. PLNI admitted that you needed these call detail records in order to trace these calls, and the jury didn't have that information, so it wasn't able, in our view, to make a determination on the calls.
Would have supported your position?
It's unclear, Your Honor, in terms of whether it would have supported our position or not.
They would have supported your position, you would have wanted to submit them to the jury.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
But so you didn't determine whether or not they would support your position
no,
or not?
No, they were not available, and it's not clear whether they would have supported our position or not, but the point was that even Peel
and
I...
How would that put the PUC in a better position than the jury if that was a state of the evidence?
I think it could have, Your Honor, in the sense that, you know, if the PUC understood that these call detail records were necessary, I think the PUC could have determined perhaps another method of determining how these calls should have been routed or investigate further. You know, the PUC has the authority to investigate further, for example, whereas the jury could not. And this particular issue was
clearly... Were we foreclosed from submitting that type of evidence to the jury?
No, I don't believe we were foreclosed from doing that, Your Honor.
Did you just say you didn't have the records?
No, I believe we had the records, Your Honor. For some reason, it was not produced or it was not available, for the trial, was my understanding, and they were not provided.
I'm just curious. So assume that you had filed a timely answer and had filed a motion to stay or a motion to dismiss based on primary jurisdiction in a timely manner, and the matter was remanded by the trial court to the PUC. What remedy would the PUC have had? For example, with respect to the $375,000 in, assuming that it was timely, it was within the 120 days, or assuming that that didn't apply, what remedy would the PUC have ordered?
I think the PUC could have ordered the credit for the 327.
What if he had refused to pay it?
If Time Warner Telecom had refused to pay, then I think the PUC could have ordered Time Warner Telecom to pay and it has regulatory authority over Time Warner Telecom with respect to billing disputes, and that's clear under the statute.
Why didn't Time Warner Telecom seek to move this matter to the PUC earlier in the proceedings? I mean, if its view now is sincerely that this is a matter that should be in front of the PUC, why not do that earlier and so that this dispute could be resolved in an orderly manner by the entity which Time Warner believes should have been considering it?
Your Honor, Time Warner Telecom, frankly, believed that the issue regarding the billing disputes were substantially resolved by the time that trial had commenced. There was a motion for summary judgment just prior to the trial to resolve the issue of this billing credit. There was a motion in limine when it was scheduled for trial to indicating that this matter had been resolved and settled. And those motions were denied by the court. In our view, the credit issue and the ongoing billing issues had been resolved earlier. And clearly the court disagreed, the circuit court disagreed. And so this matter proceeded to trial. At that point, it was clear that the resolution of these issues would certainly require the competence of the PUC on this.
When you say before trial, it was July 16th for that motion to dismiss those Group D claims and your motion for partial summary. That's a month and a half before trial. You still did nothing.
That's true, Your Honor. It is. The timing is what it is.
Mr. Kang, you made, Time made the argument during the trial that some of the things that caused maybe misbillings were attributed to parties other than Time. And you referred to those as routing problems.
That's correct.
And I think in final argument, Pacific indicated that under the tariffs, Time was responsible for making sure that these routing problems didn't occur. Is that true?
That is a provision in the tariff, Your Honor. But there are also
The jury had that provision, so the jury could, I guess, have inferred that if there were any routing problems, there were problems that Time was responsible for.
That is a provision in the tariff, Your Honor. There are also provisions, however, in the tariff that Time Warner Telecom is not responsible for third-party routing issues as well.
Right.
You are correct, Your Honor, that the jury could have read the tariff and made some sort of determination.
And those provisions, those provisions having to do with the non-liability of Time, those were given to the jury, right? There are about three provisions.
That's correct, Your Honor. The entire tariff, both the FCC tariff and the PUC tariff, were provided to the jury. Again, In our view, however, they do not constitute proper jury instructions to the jury. Otherwise, juries could be given exhibits and, you know, not instructed, essentially. And here's the contract, or here's the tariff, and this is says what it says, but in our view, that does not constitute a proper
jury. Let me ask you about sort of a tangential issue. Were all the attorney's fees and costs, were those all attributable to the trial, or did those include matters prior to trial or unrelated to the Schedule D issue?
It included matters unrelated.
Unrelated.
Okay. Right.
Did the court ever separate out which was related to the trial and which weren't?
I believe it did. It attempted to. And I believe that the circuit court attributed most of those fees and costs, frankly, to the other issues that were disputed before the trial.
Would the PUC be able to award attorney's fees?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
I'm sorry?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I don't have the specific statute in front of me, but I don't believe so.
What about Ms. Bronster's argument about the 120 days that we can infer from the jury's verdict that it, in fact, respected and applied that limit here?
I don't think we can, Your Honor. You know, certainly the jury made a determination on the figure. It perhaps changed the figure in terms of what was argued, but it's really not clear on how the jury did that or what the jury did with respect to that. And, you know, that's even clearer with respect to the ongoing billing disputes as well, in terms of if you need these call detail records and you need to understand how these routing issues are resolved, it's unclear how the jury reached the number that it did, particularly when PL&I's own witnesses testified that they weren't really sure exactly where the routing problems were either. They were not sure, you know, if Hawaiian Telecom was responsible. They were not sure if it was PL&I's own network that was having a problem. And that was undisputed at trial, that, you know, they weren't quite sure where these routing problems were occurring, on how the jury could have reached the number that it did. And that's just not clear from the jury verdict. I realize I only have 5 minutes left, but, you know, I'd like to address one thing with respect to the primary jurisdiction doctrine and this concept of technical.
Let me just ask you before you get to that. Sorry.
No.
Did either side call an expert?
No. Neither side called an expert. That being said, you know, I think the record does reflect there was a fair amount of technical testimony throughout the case by both sides on that.
But in other words, no one was actually qualified as an expert.
That's correct. No one was qualified as an expert.
But there were no objections to technical testimony.
Right.
And I assume if you felt an expert was required, because this situation was beyond what a layperson might be able to understand, then one would have been called.
Presumably so, Your Honor, in terms of, you know, if there was a need to qualify an expert, then the experts would have been qualified. Which brings me to the point, you know, on the primary jurisdiction doctrine and these technical matters. You know, under the Kona Old case and the other cases from this court has never really focused specifically on the technical issues and whether they are so complex that the circuit court cannot determine these issues, in the sense that, you know, for example, in the Kona Old case, the permitted issue the circuit court did not determine was particularly complex. You know, it was an issue regarding a minor permit, and it was a relatively small development. But I think what this court focused on, and what this court has always focused on, is that there is a regulatory scheme in which these issues are placed within the special competence of an administrative agency. Certainly, we believe this matter is complex and belongs with the PUC, but that's one factor. I think the other factors that this court is focused on, really, is that there is a regulatory scheme, and there is an agency empowered to consider these issues, regardless of necessarily the complexity or not.
Do we give juries at least the province to decide issues of fact like statute of limitations?
Yes, we do, Your Honor.
And so if you wanted to, you could characterize the 120-day issue as statute of limitations issue?
I suppose you could, Your Honor. There would be a way to fashion a jury instruction to do that.
Haven't most courts that looked at this said, you know, we have the competence on the federal and state side, that judges have the competence to recognize issues that arise when the question is whether you pay your bills or not, or whether you receive the services you paid for or not?
Certainly no disrespect to courts and juries, Your Honor, but I think this court has really focused on whether there is a regulatory scheme. Certainly, for example, in Kona Old, a jury certainly, or a court certainly, could have determined the minor permitted issue.
So we wouldn't be stepping out of the mainstream if we said this was appropriately something a court could decide because it falls within the ordinary experience of courts.
Well, Your Honor, I think factually in this matter, yes, it would be outside the experience in the sense that you do have an administrative agency with a pervasive set of statutes and administrative rules that empower this agency.
But how does the ruling in this particular case affect a broader policy issue as opposed to the sort of nitty-gritty details of the dispute between these two people? Because it's a sort of a two-part test, right? One is complexity. The other is the need for uniformity in the application of the regulatory policy. So how is that latter interest implicated, or how have you shown that latter interest is implicated? Where are there broader implications of this dispute for the entire industry that requires the PUC to be the decision maker as opposed to a court?
Yeah, I think the broader implication, Your Honor, is that, you know, if you do have a dispute involving a number of technical issues, that the circuit court should be empowered to make that determination in terms of whether the matter, because there is a
regulatory. I'm asking you, what's the issue? So in other words, tell me, oh, this is going to devastate the PUC's line of authority about kicks because it's been carefully crafted over the years, and this rogue court has now totally undercut that. The industry's in shambles. I'm not hearing that kind of argument from you.
No, Your Honor, because honestly, the primary jurisdiction doctrine is a doctrine of reason and flexibility, and under the facts of this particular case, under this record, it is appropriate.
But why? I'm asking why. Tell me the interest, tell me the regulatory interest that's implicated by this case, a broader regulatory interest. You know, in other words, you know, consistency in permitting, consistency in how people are able to access the ocean, you know, that I can understand. I'm trying to understand where's that, what's
right.
the issue here?
Right. The broader regulatory interest here is that I think issues of billing and issues of routing, you know, are technical issues that both telecommunication carriers need some consistency and guidance on going forward. This is a long-running dispute.
Okay, can I follow up with you saying they need to be, you know, it's a technical matter, so it had to be given to the PUC. In their answering brief, and you put this in bold, and this is the statement, TWTC became alerted to the technical nature of the feature group D claims on the last business day before trial. That's what you have in bold in your brief. In other words, on the last business day before trial, you decide it's so technical enough that it's got to go to the PUC. That's your statement.
I think there was a realization
at that point. You had no idea it was technical before. And I'm wondering, this is a prudential doctrine. That's what the cases say, meaning courts are to apply common sense when they invoke primary jurisdiction. And you're trying to say it became technical, you became knowledgeable about it the day before trial.
I think there was a realization that it was technical and that the jury you know, would have to grapple with these issues, and the PUC was better suited to consider these issues.
Any of your time's up? Any further very brief last thoughts, or have you been able to cover all your points?
Well, you know, with respect to the filed rate doctrine, very briefly, because we haven't really touched on that. I think that Peel and I's view of the filed rate doctrine is very narrow in terms of whether they just go to the reasonableness of the rates. I think this court's decisions, both under the Baltazar decision, the Waikoloa case, recognize that the filed rate doctrine not only goes to the rates, but also goes to the practices and the relationships between the parties. So clearly, in our view, the filed rate doctrine is much broader in this instance. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Ms. Bronster, your rebuttal.
Thank you.
Ms. Bronster, do you agree with Mr. Kane that the application of primary jurisdiction should be subject to reason and flexibility?
Absolutely. And in fact, I was quite pleased to hear that, because I think one of the problems that the ICA decision had was that it seemed to suggest that if there is concurrent jurisdiction, and if the regulatory scheme gives an agency the ability to decide something, then automatically it should be primary. And that simply is wrong. I actually feel that a very good discussion of how it should be addressed is in the first Advantel case that is cited in our pleadings. And it follows the U.S. Supreme Court case that we cite over and over again. And it says, and it cites the Ricci U.S. Supreme Court case, where it says, courts must balance the advantages of applying the doctrine against the potential costs resulting from complications and delay in administrative proceedings. It also sets out a four-part test as to, one, whether the question at issue is within the conventional experience of judges, and whether it involves technical issues. Number two, whether the question is particularly within the agency's discretion. Number three, whether there exists a substantial danger of inconsistent rulings. And four, whether a prior application has been made to the agency. These are the types of flexible analysis that I think should be considered. And I also think that the timing would go into that analysis and say that the court should not vacate a properly determined verdict from the jury.
Well, are you arguing then that primary jurisdiction would be, if you're talking about balancing factors, et cetera, would be subject to an abuse of discretion standard?
No, Your Honor.
Because that's the situation here. You have the judge has the case before it, and the judge says, primary jurisdiction, I think based on the factors, should apply. And that's after hearing the jury.
Well,
I mean, having the jury and hearing the whole case.
Your Honor, in this particular case...
Well, what I'm wondering is if you're in fact advocating that we move away from a de novo standard with respect to primary jurisdiction.
I'm not suggesting that, Your Honor, because I believe that jurisdiction, primary jurisdiction as well, should be something that the court decides de novo. However, I think that when you suggest that the circuit court made this analysis, I don't think that there's anything in the record that suggests that she actually did. I think that the court's ruling simply saying there is jurisdiction over at the PUC and I'm going to dismiss the case was error in two ways. One, by suggesting that the PUC somehow had special competence on these issues, but moreover, by dismissing rather than staying the matter and actually vacating the proper jury verdict. I want to address one issue that I believe that Mr. Kane got wrong, and the record is...
Can I just go back to that? Had your client said it would not go to the PUC? I know that's an argument Time Warner made, that in effect you limited the court's jurisdiction, or the court's ability to choose between those options. Is that accurate? Or?
Well, it is basically the reason that the Pacific LightNet believed that it would be futile to go to the PUC is because when in the Western Wireless situation where the PUC had been presented with a contractual dispute, the PUC said, although we recognize that we have concurrent jurisdiction, we are refusing to exercise that jurisdiction and think it should be handled elsewhere. And that was not once, but repeatedly. I did want the record to be clear that Mr. Kang got it wrong. PLNI repeatedly requested the call detail records. Not once, but many times. Unfortunately, I just found one reference, and I would like to make sure that you're aware of it. But Mr. Murley, Time Warner's witness, testified that he personally reviewed the call detail records that indicated that PLNI's calls came from the mainland. But he did not provide those call detail records to PLNI even after PLNI requested them. That's in the transcript of proceedings on September 10th, 2007, pages 125 to 144, Record on Appeal, Volume 13, pages 234 to 248. That is one example, but it was repeatedly requested. So I think it gets to the issue of Time Warner's efforts to not only pick its tribunal, but also pick when it would go.
Usually the law is given through the judge's instructions. So is this case unique in any way in terms of the law being set forth in exhibits given to the jury? The law being the tariffs.
No, I think, Your Honor, because the court made it clear that the tariffs were the law.
And which instruction was that?
I'm sorry. Get it in a moment. There was an instruction, and in fact, it was an instruction that we both agreed to, but it was something that Time Warner wanted more detail on. And they wanted to pick and choose which parts of the tariff would apply. We believed that the tariff, if the instructions included all the instructions that they wanted out of the tariff and additional things, it would be too complicated and irrelevant. And we wanted just the simple instruction, which they agreed to, that the
I take it, though, that the parties focused on specific parts of the tariff in their arguments.
Well, if you look at what the what Time Warner argued should have been presented, they ended up suggesting a good 15 or 20 particular parts that went far beyond.
I guess what I'm saying is that the entire tariff wasn't focused on at trial, right?
That's correct.
Okay, and Time has never raised, at least on its on the application phase of this case, never said that the court erred in not giving certain instructions.
The Time Warner did cross appeal to the ICA.
Right.
And raised certain instructions, but did not seek cert on those issues, and we don't believe that those are properly before you.
How long a document is the tariff that was submitted to evidence?
It is, there are two tariffs. One is, it is D2, and it is about, I'd say, 30 or 40 pages long. And just to complete the answer, my colleague just handed me the instruction that the tariff is the law was in the transcript, September 11th, 2007, page 44, Record on Appeal, Volume 10, page 155.
Ms. Bronster, if we conclude that we can't be confident, because this would be a matter under the filed tariff doctrine of not allowing the jury verdict to undercut, intrude, or be conflicting with the tariff. If we're concerned that the instructions that were given or the guidance that was given to the jury was inadequate, what would the, and again, I realize that's not your position, you disagree, but if we were to reach that conclusion, what would be the appropriate remedy? Would we have to vacate the entire verdict and send it back for a new trial, or is there some intermediate step that could be taken in your view?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the $327,000 is unaffected by that because it's admitted.
So that would only apply to the second group of claims?
Yes, Your Honor. The $327,000 is admitted, and there was no question that Time Warner stated that it was appropriate. Um, If I may.
Yeah, you may wrap up. That's just my, with Mr. Kang, I gave him the chance to wrap up. You may quickly wrap up as well.
I think one of the problems with leaving the case as is that the implications are horrific. It enables a company like a regulated industry like Time Warner to simply decide, even after a jury verdict or after a judgment, that perhaps it didn't like the outcome and can go to the PUC. But more importantly, the PUC is simply never been set up to handle collection matters or billing disputes, and it would lead to a bottleneck that was never intended by the regulatory scheme and was never intended by the setup. And quite frankly, the law, the regulatory scheme that does exist, prevents a hearings officer from even hearing anything relating to billing. So the concept would be that suddenly the regulatory agencies would be thrown into the administrative body that is ill-equipped to handle it when the courts are perfectly equipped and the jury not only was equipped but handled it with no problem and no questions asked. Thank you.
Thank you. The court will take this matter under advisement.